Hey, this is Jeff Tomei, and welcome to Whatever Nevermind. Enjoy the interview about Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream.
Right on. I have happy to have back on the program Jeff Tomei. I had you on as a producer of the Jerry Cantrell record. Today we're talking about Siamese Dream by the Smashing Pumpkins, of which you were the engineer on.
That's correct. Yep. Many, many, many years ago now at this point.
Yeah. Well, welcome back. Let's start off with how did you get the gig? Like, how were you brought in to be the engineer on that project?
You know, I was really fortunate. I had been working out of a studio in Atlanta called Triclops, and Butch was basically kind of calling around trying to find some places that weren't in New York or L.A. and for many different reasons. And he needed somebody to you know, run the studio and run the board and stuff. I mean, Butch is a competent engineer, obviously, but it worked out in my favor that I was the guy for that. So I can't tell you how fortunate I was that worked out for me.
Right on. So that was your first time working with Butch then, I guess?
Yep. The funny little side note story is the guy that managed the studio and owned it, he got the call when Butch was checking out studios, and his name is Rick, and he was kind of standoffish, and he said, "Well, who have you worked with?" And Butch said, "Well, I did Nirvana's Nevermind." And Rick says, "Oh, that Butch Vig." Yeah, that one.
Oh, I was confused with another one.
Yeah.
That was a nice recovery, if you think about it.
Oh, I know. Oh, that one, okay. Yeah, the 20 others that have called Butch Vigs, they weren't you.
Well, you know, this is largely, you know, especially, I mean, this is your career, so this is all these projects are, you know, are your job. Do you like the Smashing Pumpkins? Is this a record you're a fan of?
I'm a fan of the record, but to be honest with you, I didn't have a clue about their music going into the record.
Okay.
Nothing. I didn't know anything about it. And, you know, it was a tough record to make and took a while. And I got to say, it was a good solid year before I even listened to the record.
Oh, boy.
You just get burned out. But I listen to it now, and it's just like, yeah, that's a pretty good record. I'm pretty happy with it.
Any specific, like, memories or stories before we get into the – because I have a bunch of questions regarding that. But anything from your own personal kind of, like, viewpoint that stuck out when you think about this album, working with any of the members or Butch or just the process in general? Anything at all, really? Something you find
Well, out. I mean, with Butch, it was just an absolute just a fun record to make because Butch has got that kind of personality about him. He just kind of keeps things light when he can, and just super talented. So that was awesome. And you know, same thing can be said with Billy. Billy is an amazingly talented guy. So the you know, good memories of just great playing and parts and everything on that record for sure. We'll maybe get into it at some point, but we had a blizzard for the South, which is for us, which was really, you know, 2-3 feet of snow. It was a lot of snow down here.
Sure.
And they shut it down. And I remember calling Butch that morning and saying, "We're not going to be able to work." And he said, "Well, it's just snow," because he's from Green Bay area. And I said, "No, it's not just snow here." I says, "I promise you, you won't be able to get to the studio. And if you get there, you won't be going anywhere for a couple of days."
Wow.
So that was, in 93, the first part of 93, I guess it was around March or whenever that big, the famous blizzard of 93 went down.
The famous 2-foot blizzard. Now, so it's because you guys don't have snow plows and stuff of that nature, right? Or the road salting equipment.
Yeah, that's the real facts about it. It's like we're not geared for that because it rarely happens, and there's no sense having salt trucks and all that kind of stuff sitting around if they're not going to be used most of the time. I mean, it happens once every 15 years or so, it seems like. But when it does, we shut down. There's just nowhere to go. People can't. There's no. The roads are an impasse because, again, we're not really prepared for it. But I know it's a funny thing for you Northerners. But
yeah. It takes a lot for us to get the day off from work. Not so much from school nowadays. Anyway, they preemptively call off school like they never did when I was a kid. But you know, they're just looking at the safety of it, I guess. So
it's the safety and the liability, and I don't blame them.
Sure.
There's a lot of lives to be under your wing, I guess you could say.
Right on. Well, I did know the pumpkins a little bit. I was fortunate to get into Gish. It was recommended to me by someone that I worked at the college radio station where I went. They thought I might like that record, and they told me, you know, to start playing it on the show, and I ended up just stealing it and taking it home to listen to it. So I was a little bit anticipating the follow-up to it. It is clearly a step up in production and songwriting. We just recorded the episode where we actually go through the album and break it down, and one of the things that when I went, I haven't really listened to this record in a long time, but listening back, I think like mentally, my brain was set that Gish was my favorite record. This record is just amazing. It's just been so long and so much separation. I just think I had some kind of built in, you know, bias against it or something like that. But not. I don't know if I'm making any sense there. But
yeah.
Have you gone back to hear any of the, like, did you hear Gish later on, or have you checked out any of the other stuff?
That's a brilliant record. I think that record's amazing. And if you think about it, as Butch had explained, I mean, it was, you know, they were on what the indie on Caroline, I think, was the record label, which was part of Virgin, was part, but that was like the one of their imprints or whatever, however you want to word it. But no, I think it's a great record. But that also was kind of like the bar where it's like, okay, well, we know we've got to go and beat that. That was Butch's, you know, discussion all along. Well, we've got a record that we're proud of that did really well for what it was. And he said, so we got to, you know, the bar is here now.
Yeah, it did. It seemed like reading on some interviews with Billy and Butch, it some of the pressure on what they needed to do almost seems unrealistic, because as much as I like Gish, that most people really hadn't heard it. So, but the label clearly had some, I don't know, expectations, because they kept paying for it.
Well, then the thing with Gish is the label, the label for what it was in the dollars that went into that one, it was a very successful record.
Sure.
I think they sold, you know, I don't know how many units. But
I think
sold
I came across about 40,000, which is a lot for an independent record.
Yeah, it is. And so it was, and basically that record was what gave them, how do you want to word it, gave them the ability to take a step up to the major of Caroline, which was Virgin. Is it Virgin they were on? Now I'm losing my mind on that.
You would think I'd have that memorized by this point, but I don't think that's right for some reason. I don't have the CD.
Yeah, it's Virgin. It's Virgin.
It is?
Yep.
Okay, all right.
Yep. The only reason I know, because I'm in my office, and I'm not saying this to name drop, but I had to go look at the record on the wall, and it says Virgin Records.
Oh, so, nice.
But that gave them the ability.
So you have a platinum award, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty proud of that.
You got a few of them, I suppose.
I've got one for Matchbox. I got several for the Matchbox, which was awesome. And then I got there's the one and the 3 million. And I don't know where Siamese Dream is now. They don't really keep up with those kind of things anymore, as far as you getting those records. But you know, I'll take it. I'm not complaining. Trust me.
Well, a quick side note on that. I've always been curious. Like, does it just show up in a crate at your house one day, or do you know it's coming? Okay.
Yeah. No, it does. And you know. These kind of showed up. I remember my wife said, there's some big box that came. I got one for that movie, Queen of the Dam, the soundtrack for that I mixed some songs on. And she says, I think it's a gold record, because she knows what the box looks like. So that was pretty awesome. But they show up. UPS just drops it off.
I don't know if you want to or care, but if you could send, I don't know, if someone could take a picture of you in front of that, I'd include that in some of the show art.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Oh, right on. You can just send it to me via text, but that's pretty cool. I wasn't even thinking about that. Of course you got one. Let's get into some of the drama that surrounded this record. Did you know about the whole Darcy and James Iha kind of mess leading into this? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I was told fairly early on in the project that they had been together. They were, you know, a couple or whatever, and we're no longer a couple. So the underlying tension was already there with that.
Man.
As if there wasn't enough tension. But, yeah, that I found out maybe a week or so. And you start finding out these things, and Butch was pretty forthcoming, and as was Billy about, you know, things like that. So, you know, they pretty much just went their own paths kind of there, other than the basic tracking, because that's how we would do it. We'd track everybody and then really just go for the it was all on 2-inch tape, really just go for the drum edit and get the drum master take down and build it from there.
Okay. Oh, explain the significance of it being on 2-inch tape versus a different tape. Is there something I don't know?
No, it's just it's multi-track, 24-track. I just say that because that's what I came up on is working off of, okay, you know, tape base and editing tape and doing actual razor blade edits, which in that era, that's all we had. I mean, Pro Tools was kind of in its infancy. I didn't have a clue about that. So it was that a palette of reels of 2-inch tape, which there were, I think there were 45 reels of them showed up when we started that record. That's a lot of tape.
Yeah. Wow.
A lot of tape. So that's that, and that's how we did it. We tracked with them live, all in one room, and with the guitars and bass isolated, that kind of thing. But and really just go for a master take on Jimmy's drums.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jimmy as a drummer then, because I mean, he's got a really good reputation as a drummer. But this would have been like only his second time, you know, recording a full album or something like that in a studio, and the first time with a big budget. What was he like to work with? Was he a quick you know, record, or what, did it take a lot of takes, or
no? He was very quick, and he was a pro at that point, man. He was comfortable in the studio. I didn't get any indication that there was any kind of nerves or that. You know, there were some songs that were a little more of a struggle because it's a, you know, what the issue would not issue, but we would get those songs. We'd find a tempo that felt good, and we'd start the count off with a click track. And then we'd stop it, and they'd play. So everything was played live. It's not really played to any kind of click track, which is pretty common today. But Butch, being a drummer himself, wanted the tracks really solid and tight. So it took a lot of editing, not because Jimmy was not a competent drummer, it was because Butch wanted a really super tight record, you know, timing wise.
When you say editing, so he's taking parts of multiple takes.
Well, yeah, that was a given. With that, we'd build a. He'd kind of script it out on paper, you know, use the intro from take three, cut the first verse from take five. And again, you're juggling 2-inch tape back and forth. So he'd give me that legend, as it were, and then I'd put it together. And then once we knew we had a master take of it, then it'd be like, okay, now we need to tighten up the drums. And he'd say, okay, that snare's a little bit late right there. Make it early. So you cut a chunk of tape out, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, it got pretty scientific because he'd find the bars, a bar or two that felt good, and said, that's whatever that tempo is, that's what the whole song needs to be. And so we pretty much cut tape like you do now with Pro Tools and moving things around, where it would, you know, be a solid, you know, drum take. It's got some life in it. It's not perfect because it wasn't played to a click track, but it's pretty tight.
Right on. Yeah. It's, I mean, the drums are well, first of all, there's not a lot I can pick apart at the production of this record. I do have one small critique we'll get to here. But the drums definitely aren't it. They are immaculate. And the thing about Jimmy that kind of stuck out was that his style of drumming was not really in vogue for grunge. You know, I mean,
no.
Even having that kind of that size of a kit and the fact that it worked well with the Pumpkins, I don't know. I think it says a lot. I mean, I think I have a lot of respect for him as a drummer.
He I do too. He's a fan of big band music and swing and that kind of stuff. And it shows in his playing, because you can, every swing also means how you, you know, the groove with the drums. So he was a student of that. So he knew how to really make it feel good. But that aside, he and Reed Mullen of Corrosion of Conformity were two of the hardest hitting drummers I've ever worked with.
Okay.
Just pounders, just beating them up, but accurate. So, and again, it's nice because it was recorded to tapes. There's a lot of nice tape compression and things that go on that don't go on nowadays with digital recordings.
Yeah.
That make things more pleasing to the ear.
A little back to a little bit of the drama, because Jimmy had some of his own. Were you aware that some of the drug issues that he was dealing with, like what I read from both Butch and Billy, is that they went to Atlanta largely to stay out of a big city like New York, and also to get away from Chicago, because they were worried about, you know, Jimmy's friends and drug dealers being around.
That's true. In an interview that Butch had given years ago, it was like, well, within 24 hours, he knew all the hookups in Atlanta, so it didn't really matter. But I will share this with you it seems like because of those issues, we would track two songs at a time. We'd work on one couple of songs to about 80% done, and then move on. That way, it wasn't like, okay, drums are done after 2 weeks, now you can go just do what you want. We didn't do it that way.
I was literally going to ask, not for that reason, but like, you know, did he just disappear once the drums were done, or were the drums recorded across the recording? So that was actually done to help keep him clean, huh? Oh, but go ahead. You said he would disappear?
Yeah, he had his disappearing days. I think the longest stretch, I think he didn't show up for about 5 days. And of course, we had things we could work on, obviously, but it didn't sit too well with Billy. So,
and it was
which obviously, you know, we're trying to make a record. There's money being spent, a lot of money.
Yeah, and this is pre-cell phone, so there's like, you can't even, like, the guy won't even answer his phone. So I suppose you don't even know where he's at, huh?
So that was one way. And, you know, in tracking the record also, we did a lot of extra music, which some of it wound up on that B-side record, Pisces Iscariot. Mm-hmm. We did, I think we tracked, and my memory could be off, but it was 25, 26 songs. And some of them would just start off with Billy playing something on a mellotron and Jimmy playing drums.
Wow.
And just turn it into a song. Some of it was just jamming, and some of it never saw the light of day, but a good bit of it did. I think there's 14 songs on Siamese Dream, and then I think there's four or five on Pisces that were from that session too. So, pretty good numbers for doing that many songs. So,
Before I get into that, how were you like working with Billy? Did you spend a lot of time interacting with the members of the band, or was it largely through Butch?
No, we interacted. I mean, it's like every record. You get in tight with these guys. You get in really tight with them. You can't help but because you're there with them for 14, 16 hours a day. And the last month, we didn't take a day off. So, yeah, no, I got to know him really well. I mean, you can't help but get in tight with these people. He was a taskmaster. He knew what he wanted. He didn't waste time. We didn't have chit-chat time. When we were working, we were working. So wow. He had a very good idea of what he wanted the record to be like. He was ready.
So as far as working, he was not that big of an issue or anything like that?
He could be a challenge. He could be a challenge, but so can a lot of artists you work with. I mean,
we all have our moments, Jeff.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And again, we're working on tape. We're you know, it's not Pro Tools. Oh, well, I missed that punch. I'll just fix it in Pro Tools. It's just like, oh, you got to be on every time. You can't screw this up.
Yeah.
And the common knowledge is that he played most everything on the record other than drums. So it was me and Billy and Butch most of the time, most of the record, other than the basic tracking when, like I said, everybody tracks together.
Well, Billy's talked a lot about his mental state leading up to the writing and recording of the record. Did he seem, I don't know, for lack of a better term, suicidal? He's mentioned it.
No, he didn't seem that way, but he was. There was a lot of anxiety. You could tell there was a lot on him. Somebody the age he was then, or myself too, but at the age he was, that's a lot of stress and pressure to put on somebody. So you could tell there was a lot of pressure on him. But I didn't get this. I didn't get anything. I know he's mentioned it, and I know he has had those moments, but not that I know of making that record.
Right. No, I'm asking for your perspective. You know, and
sure.
With Darcy. You know, kind of him filling in and taking over on. Let's start with her. Did Were you there to like see her try to do anything and it just wasn't working, or?
Yeah, the way it typically worked out in my memory, after the tracking, then we'd get the drums, put those together, make a master take, and then we'd go to move on the bass. And Billy would be in the control room. Darcy would come in and he'd have her play through the song one time or so just to kind of get the vibe that whatever. And then he'd say, all right, give me the bass. And that was it. Then he put the bass tracks on. That was standard, you know, operating for that record.
Did she play on anything?
I don't know why it sticks in my memory. I think there was one song. I think Luna. I think that's one that she actually played bass on. And I don't remember why, so I could be wrong. But I don't know why it sticks in my mind that there was one song on that record she played on. And she actually sang a couple little small harmony parts, but for the most part, you know, just like with James probably put 5% of the guitars on. Okay. You know, it's almost all him. But, you know, in fairness to Billy knew what he wanted. He was ready to make the record, and I don't know that was the same with those two. So,
yeah, I've never approached that level of recording, but I have recorded 5 albums. I know what it's like to work with people. I've never not been there when something was happening, you know, but it's kind of being the singer and the songwriter. It's almost required, where other people would be, I just want to do my stuff and then leave. And,
yeah.
And so I get it, especially if you're trying to really create the specific thing. How much time are you going to fuck around with someone that clearly doesn't seem to have the same level? Oh, well, let's just say ability or commitment. Who knows what it is? You know what I mean? But yeah, I've never really harped on him too much for that. It wasn't like he brought in Steve Vai to replace James Hiha. It's still a member of the Pumpkins playing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there were a couple of times when there would be a part and the conversation was, well, that part doesn't work. I told you months ago that part didn't work. And it'd be like, well, that's the part I have. Okay, well, I'll do it. You know, so were they ready? I don't know how prepared they were. He was super prepared, but again, he's the songwriter, singer and all that. So, yeah. So he should be, but you know, I look back on it as, you know, you did what for any record, you do what you have to do to get the record done. Cause yeah. The label doesn't care about any of that stuff. They just want a record done.
Sure. Hey, I thought of something when you were talking about the drum master track. So you get them all in the room together. You record the three or four. Like how many? Well, that's maybe I'll start there. So like let's say we'll start with one song, Cherub Rock or whatever. It doesn't have to be that one. But typically, how many drum takes would you record? But that you would end up splicing from?
Well, on a reel of 2-inch tape, you. Depending on the length of the song, you can get 3 or 4 takes on there. So, you know, there may have been 3 reels full. There may have been 9 takes. I don't know specifically, but yeah, but there were definitely multiple takes that were cut between to make a master of it. So it just depends on the song, how many takes, but, you know. And they weren't specific. They weren't necessarily because, okay, well, that's it may be because it didn't feel right or the arrangement's not
sure.
Exactly where it needs to be, that kind of stuff. But I think that was pretty standard as far as, you know, just throw up another reel. Let's do another couple takes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm asking really more for kind of the geeky nerd end of like of this stuff. Not to be critical of Jimmy, that's for sure.
Sure.
So then Butch listens back. And how long does it take for him to listen to all the takes and make his notes?
Well, and see, that's people say, how does it take so long to make a record? Okay, well, you get the takes down. So say you did 3 reels of takes. You got 9, you have 9 takes of that. All right, then you have to go through each one, take notes, pick out what part. So that's, you know, you're talking about a day.
Right.
You're talking about a solid day.
To me, it sounds very arduous, yeah.
It is.
It'd almost be easier to just say, Jimmy, play it 40 more times, and we're just going to get one good one.
Yeah, but here's the thing is, again, Butch is a solid drummer, and what he it's so subjective what he's hearing and what he wants to get out of something might not be. It may have felt fine the whole take, but it's just not record worthy in Butch's mind, I guess. And
oh,
you know,
I'm not suggesting that I'm right. I'm just like,
oh yeah, yeah.
I love the breaking this thing down. So
it's you know, and then you. Okay, so he gets his legend charted out, and depending on what time of day it is, I'll start cutting on that. But you know, that's a, you know, to put the master together, that's another couple of hours, depending on how many takes we have to go through to make a master. Once we get it together, then you spend another couple hours trimming it down, saying, okay, that snare's a little late. Let's make that feel better in the pocket. Let's make it a little early. So you're looking at probably 2 days there.
So the initial trim down, like when he gives you your notes, you can do that in a couple hours?
Yeah, I got where I could put together master tape pretty quick. I'd been cutting, at that point, fortunately for me, I'd been cutting tape for a good, you know, 10 years in studios, because that's what we had and that's what we knew. So I'd gotten pretty good and quick on that. And then it was the fine tuning stuff that took a little more time, right. You know, and to get it to feel right from top to bottom. So.
In both times we've talked, I don't know if you remember, but I've all of a sudden stopped and taken like a sideways thing into this tape trimming thing. Man, I'll tell you what, if I'm ever in Atlanta, I'm going to look you up and you can give me a demonstration.
Well, I don't ever want to cut tape again because Pro Tools is so easy. And if I think about it now, I think, how did we do that? It was pretty involved. But if it's all you know, that's how you make a record. That's what it was for us. It was like, okay, that's how you make records.
Well, a little bit about a question about Butch. Now, see, you kind of have quite a bit of drama going on between. It doesn't sound like Billy's personal issues were affecting the recording too much, so we'll skip that. But you got Jimmy with all that stuff, and then of course Darcy and James not really getting a chance to play, and then of course kind of not really, you know, they're not really wanting to talk to each other either. This seems kind of chaotic considering all this stuff. What was Butch's demeanor like during all that?
Well, and as was saving grace to it, Butch took the whole other tact. It's just like, I'm just going to be laid back and chill. And I don't think he's trying to be that way. That's just that's the Butch I know.
Yeah.
He was completely the opposite. Billy could get intense and then more intense and angry about some things. He would get the calmer Butch got and the more like, okay, well, we'll make this happen. You know, he was just super chill with most things. So it wasn't like, to me, it was a good middle ground, because if it were on both sides, all that, you know, anxiety and all that pressure, it would have been even harder to record to make than it already was.
That was a good balance, basically.
It was a great balance. He knew how to, you know, bring Billy down a notch when he needed to, just by being, you know, Butch, being just chill and okay, let's make this happen. Let's do this. Let's try this. That kind of thing. Instead of getting there and play it, and it better be good.
What kind of thing would set Billy off? What would he get angry about?
It just depends. I remember one specific thing where, again, this is on tape, so everything you do, you're punching in, punching out, and he's playing a bass track. And there was one spot that was a tough spot to get, and we probably punched in 30 times in that spot. And then, you know, the 30th time I was late on the punch and missed it. He said, are you going to make me play this all day? like it was me that was slowing up the process.
Yeah, you fucked it up at that point though.
Yes. Yeah, I did. And then he said that. I had a pencil in my left hand and was about to snap it in two. I was like, what? But you know, that's part of it too. You that's what it's like a 4 or 5 month marriage with making records. You're in there that tight with people for that amount of time, and then the breakup at the end. The record's done, okay, we're breaking up.
So spending all this time, was there ever like a dayer or a dinner or maybe like, I don't know, going bowling or something that you would spend with them outside?
No. One exception, I think we had a cookout one day. The Vince was like, I forget Vince's last name, but he was like Billy's right hand guy. He did the guitar teching. He did the running. He did everything.
Okay.
He was Billy's guy. And we were working one weekend, and they decided there was a back patio out the back of the studio, or really it's just a loading dock, and decided they were going to have a barbecue with brats and stuff like that. So, but, I mean, we were working around that. It wasn't like we stopped for 3 hours, you know?
Yeah.
So while Vince was cooking, once it was ready, then we had our lunch and that was it. But for the most part, you know, everybody was kind of, all right, we'll take a 15-minute break. Let's grab a sandwich real quick.
Right,
there was not a lot of free time.
Okay. Let's get into the record a little bit. Now, you mentioned it yourself. I've read leading up to this, too, that the days would be like 12 to 14-hour days. Is that 12 to 14 hours for you as well?
Well, there's more than that, because I'd get there before. I always say being an engineer is like being in the Marine Corps. You're the first in and last out.
Sure.
is the comp quote I've always heard. So you're there, you know, hour before, and if you're having to make rough or whatever things at the end. So the days could be, you know, a solid 16 or 18 sometimes. It just, you know, it's definitely a career field, and it was better for a younger guy that I was then. And having that energy, because there's long hours, long days. I used to say, you know, if you think about somebody that works an 8-hour job, if they went in at the end of their 8-hour job, they were told they had to work another 8 hours. People would say, "What? You're crazy." But it wasn't anything for us to work those kind of hours. It's just, that's what engineers did. That's what making a record was about. You put in a lot of hours. Most studios book by the day, and they don't necessarily limit the hours. And so it's just like, let's get as much done as we can. You know,
you don't ever thought about that. I think for the artist, it probably isn't that big a deal. They're into it. They're always connected to it, you know, with a certain amount of emotion and passion, but not necessarily the people doing all the work. That's a very fair. I think it's a valid comparison. Like somebody working a regular job, working 8 and saying, "I need you to do another 8 and then do it the rest of the week, too.
Another analogy, and it still goes on to this day. Say I have a band in the studio today, and there's 5 guys. Mm-hmm. So we get a drum track, and then I put it together of whatever edits and Pro Tools. Then the bass player's standing behind me, ready to go. When he's done, then the guitar player's ready for his rhythm, and the lead player's ready. And so I was like, there aren't any breaks for the unless you just. I do it at my age now. I said, no, we're taking a 15-minute break or whatever. But then it's like everybody's waiting in line to keep going, and so the guy in the chair is still in the chair the whole time. Uh-huh. The bass player's done. He's sitting in the lounge watching television or something. So, you know, that kind of vibe. But again, I'm not complaining. It was my chosen profession. And it's just like there's a lot of work. People don't realize what kind of work goes into making a record.
So what are James and Darcy doing during this time?
In the lounge watching television most of the time. No, seriously, that was it.
No, I believe, yeah.
Because, I mean, what would they do? I mean, like I said, the few times that James put a part on or played a part. He did play one of the intro guitars to Mayonnaise, which was a challenge in itself because it was a cheap pawn shop guitar he insisted on playing, and the intonation was terrible. So we pretty much spent a whole day, pretty much spent 12 hours to get that one intro part.
Well, and you're just talking at the very beginning there, not that squeaky thing that goes through there.
Just that clean, yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, you brought up Mayonnaise, possibly my favorite track on the record. You have to know that high pitched squeal I'm talking about between a little, you know,
another pawn shop guitar. It was called a Kimberly, I think it was, that Billy was playing, and the pickups were just microphonic. So we had him play in front of his cabinet, and he could control that feedback. But that's it; it's just feeding back through the pickups in those stops.
I listened to it in preparation for this, and I specifically listened to that part. It is amazing how, because I assume that there's some layers to it. The rumor is that there's hundreds of guitar tracks in this thing. Either way, but the fact that it's very consistent, perfectly timed, but also slightly different every time is amazing to me.
Well, it's definitely, and the rumors of 100 tracks have been greatly exaggerated. There are a lot of tracks, but that was probably double, maybe a triple of that. But that's him play. I mean, again, this is not Pro Tools, and once you get the drums edited, you can't edit the guitars. They either have to fit or they don't. So that's Billy and Billy's talent playing and making that work, and locking in and getting the double track to that. It was always through some sort of pedals, and the Big Muff was his you know, main pedal, and those are noisy. Yeah. They're loud, they're gainy, they're noisy. So rather than, like, I keep going to Pro Tools because that's how I work in now, where you can just say, I'll just clean this up from here before he started playing. Well, this was like you had to keep the mutes on the microphones till downbeat there, so everything stayed clean because, you know, again, that's how you did it then. So the noise and the volume level of the Big Muff rhythm guitars was just crazy.
So that part was – that guitar was used just to make that noise?
No, that guitar, he's playing the whole rhythm.
Okay,
on there,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, that's it. That's him playing, but that's him hitting those stops like that and working that microphonic pickup to that feedback. You know, he basically played the feedback in the holes, which is great. He's playing the whole thing on those. And I don't know – I don't know if it was in vogue for in alternative bands or whatever you want to call them back then, but it seemed like a lot of them would come through playing just the crappiest guitars.
Yeah, it definitely was in vogue, yeah.
Through good amps, but they played – and I'm thinking that the one that James played was called a Kingston. Never heard of it in my life. He said, I paid $85 for it. Yeah, I can tell. That kind of thing. And then Billy plays the Kimberly, but that's a signature – that signature in that song. Everybody talks about that mayonnaise, that song.
It's such a killer tune. Any chance Mayonnaise was a working title that he just never came up with anything better?
That I don't know. It was always Mayonnaise. I don't know. The one interesting footnote is we were jamming on just like one of the little B-side jams or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're using track sheets back then and labeling stuff. So, all right, Billy, what's this song called? And he said, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Oh, really?
Which became the album title. Yeah. Had no relation to that, but that was the title. And that, when that record came out, that one, I was like, oh, that was that B-side song.
Oh, so do you remember what B-side, what did that ever get released?
I think it was one of the throwaway ones that never saw the light of day.
Okay, all right.
I think, I mean, again, I could be, but I don't think it ever made. I think he just threw that title out. But yeah, back to Mayonnaise, it was always called Mayonnaise.
Hmm.
It was always Cherub Rocket. It was always Today. It was always Rocket. I don't know any of them became, whereas on that Corrosion record I was telling you I did, they were all working titles. When the record came out, I said, I don't know any of these songs.
when it was done, huh? Like, they still had...
Well,
like,
when it was done, I said, yeah, I remember...
I mean the recording of it.
Yes, yeah. Crazy.
Oh, man. Well, I got a question about Disarm that's very specific. You know that it's like an underlying cello kind of dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun that goes through the verses. Do you remember?
That's what it is.
Oh, damn it. Jeff, I had myself convinced that it was actually like, you know, a layered acoustic picking that just because you built so many up that there was like this cello kind of sound to it, but it was an actual cello, huh? I know there's other strings on it, but...
Well, the acoustic is doing the picking, but what you're hearing, that's a cello, and The interesting thing about that song is that it was a violin player and a cello player.
Okay.
The cello player was a friend of Billy's from Chicago. The violin player at that time was the violin player in the band Kansas. And David Ragsdale was his name. And so they came in and there weren't any charts. Usually with string players, you got to write charts. Billy said it was guitar. The good thing about David Ragsdale, because he was a rock guy, he could take what Billy was doing and chart it out. So he charted it out for the cello player and for him.
Hmm.
And we used a whole, I don't know if you're familiar, but you have an A reel, a master reel, then you have a B reel that you lock together. So that gives you 48 tracks, typically. Well, we went to a C reel because we needed to have room for the strings. So we took a mix to one of the 24 tracks, just a stereo mix. We probably did 20 overdubs on the strings. It's a lot of layers because it's two guys and we wanted to make it sound like an orchestra.
No.
So, lot of layers.
That was a song on First Spin that I knew was going to be gigantic. I mean, it's just it's just too good.
Well, we knew from early on that, and Butch said it from day one, that Cherub Rock was going to be the first single.
Mm-hmm.
Without a doubt, no matter what. And usually that's not really said. Usually you just kind of see how the songs shape up.
Oh, really? Okay.
What seems like the best. On a lot of times, sometimes people go in with preconceived notions, but that was always going to be it. So even added pressure to making that song really stand out was like, this is going to be the first single. Okay. Hmm. It better be great then.
Yeah, I mean, it's good enough that I'm sick of it, and I think it's a brilliant tune. So,
that one did kind of, it got a lot of play. Rocket's my favorite song on the record, which
really?
I don't think
no.
it ever became, quote, a single, but because there was Today, which we knew that was what they wanted for the first single. The record label really said, that's too pop.
Yeah.
Nope, that's not us, not to start with. And then it became a single, and Disarm, I forget, there were probably at least three singles I know of off that record. So,
yeah, I mean, those are definitely those three. I'm not sure beyond that. Today never really connected with me. At the same time, I think it's brilliant. It's like I can separate my personal taste from it and still accept that I get why people love this tune. This is just so perfectly written, and it's not easy to say something as simple as Today is the Greatest and also make it that kind of relatable and with that hook, you know what I mean?
I agree. Yeah. And that one was interesting in the texture, in that we cut between two different kind of drum sounds. We had it, for the verses, it's a real dry. We dried the drums up and had them in real smaller kind of space. And then so we did takes where the choruses are, the rooms opened up and it's big, you know, rock and roll bottom kind of room. And it's not that extreme on the record, but I do remember that being cut together like that.
And so they were tracked differently. Yep. And that's just one of you going doing, making the master track magic that you do.
Yep. Let's take the more live drums. They're going to be the chorus. We're going to cut those in there. So, and that amp, that clean amp is this piece together thing that one of the techs at the studio owned. And, and that became that signature kind of clean sound there on the main one, on the intro and the verses of that.
And the guitars have just such a beefy low end, but it's not quite that stoner rock thing that we're more familiar with now, but it's kind of leaning that way. I assume that has a lot to do with the Big Muff that you were talking about.
It absolutely does, and because there's that just lends itself to that. And then it's taped too, so that it's got that bump in the low mids. And then when I do recall we put the bass on, Billy says, "I don't care if you can hear the note definition. I just need more weight, more weight, more weight." That's what he kept saying. So it was all about having that. So the bass also carries a whole lot of that too. But the guitars, yeah, they're pretty beefy sounding. The most guitar tracks I recall was the song called Hummer, uh-huh. and it's not because there's that many just are playing at the same time, but there were a lot of layers and overlaps and stuff like that. So. Tape can be a challenge because you don't have these endless tracks like you do now. It's like, okay, we got to plan this out.
I love Hummer, by the way. That's a killer tune.
That's a great song. I told Butch when they left, I said, "This is going to take you a week to mix this one." He says, "Nah." And then he sends me a fax back in the fax days. And he said, "We've been working on Hummer for 5 days." Because it's just dense. There's a lot of tracks on that.
What's he doing sending faxes? You got to get in there and mix this.
Yeah, I know.
Here's my one critique, and maybe you can lend some insight, because it seems like it's probably what they wanted, but to me the vocals sound, there's a little tin to it. I know Billy's voice isn't something that people like. I enjoy his voice. I just think this record, compared to the other ones, there's a little kind of like, I don't know, the best way I can describe it, and so don't get mad at me, I'm just trying to describe what I hear, is it sounds like a cheap microphone was used.
Well, I'll give you Billy's, one of his comments early on was, is there anybody in the music business that has less bass in their voice than me? That was his critique himself. Okay. And also the vocals are doubled through everything, even in most songs, even in the verses. But we used a dynamic mic, which, you know, typically mm-hmm. people use a tube mic or a condenser. We used a SM7 on his vocals because that seemed to fit him better than had a tube 47 that sounded great. But and those are only good if you just eat the mic and you get the proximity effect. So again, it's a lot of characteristics of his voice, and then probably a little bit to do with the mic choice or whatever. But again, and it's all doubled. So, mm-hmm. so you ask, you know, people again, how do you take so long making a record? Well, say you do a vocal, okay? You do 10 takes of a vocal, and then you have to comp it, put it together, make the composite, and then you have to go back. And if you're going to build a double, then you've got to build a double. So that's like 2 days in the making, right there.
Wow.
So time goes by fast.
Yeah, and I'm being hypercritical with that. Overall, this is a record that I absolutely adore, but. Well, let's get a little bit to some of the tracks here. Are there any songs that looking back that really were fun to record, or anything particular that you like an anecdote to share about recording it?
Well, I most of them were. I think all of them were fun to record in a challenge. But there's a song on the record called Sweet Sweet. I can't remember. It's one of the later tracks.
Yeah, it's like second to last.
It came off a 4-track cassette deck.
Okay.
Where Billy, that's his demo. So we took he had two acoustic guitars. We redid the vocals, but he had the two acoustic guitars. I'll clarify that. Came off of that. And because he wanted to use that, he said, "That feels good. I want that." So we bounced the out of a cassette player onto two tracks on a 24 track tape machine. and built it off of that. Again, it's a real simple song. There's not anything to it other than the guitars and the vocals. I think there's I don't remember if there's Mellotron. I might be thinking of Soma, but or Luna. But either way, it was interesting that, you know, you're doing this big budget record, but then you're going to take one song and it's just going to be demo acoustic guitars off a cassette deck.
No, this is a slightly better four track than like those Tascams that were a couple $100 on the time.
No,
right?
That's pretty much what it was.
Come on.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, that's pretty much
I never
it was.
Got
it was,
anything close to sonically clean as that.
It was one of those Porta Studio, whatever they call them. I forget what. I think it was something similar to that.
Ah, fuck that.
Which, to take a little left turn, is Jerry Cantrell had bought one of those little cheap cassette things because he wanted to work on songs when we were making the record with him. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, we've got the studio. We can, you know, why are we doing this on a four-track cassette? Or why are you? I wasn't part of it. He'd take it home with him and work on stuff, which made sense. But anyway, that's where those guitars came from.
Wow.
But the argument could be made, you know, the Stone Street Fight, man, that's exactly what they did with that one. That was Keith recording into a cassette deck, and they'd bounce those to tape and overdub. That's where those acoustics are coming from.
Yeah, I remember when I first started learning Pro Tools, which I probably have 3% of what it can actually do is what I can actually make it do. That's probably a lot more than the Beatles had.
Oh, yeah. Pro Tools is just what the medium we work in now. And I said, you know, people say, what if the Beatles, what if this had been around during the Beatles? I said, they would have used it. I said, they were cutting edge on what they did for technology. They would have jumped all over it. You're kidding me?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were looking for anything, man. The song Soma that you mentioned just a minute ago, the music at the very beginning of that, I'm speaking sonically, is just recorded immaculately, and I know this whole record is really well produced, but there's just something so smooth and clean and pleasant when you listen to that. I don't know if there was any trick there, but that's one that sticks out for me.
It's just the vibe. It is such a chill vibe on the song anyway. Yeah. Again, it's capturing that emotion, which is why it's important. I still think to this day, it's important if the band can track everything live, even if you don't keep anything but the drums, then they still have a certain feel. It's better to keep everything you can, but anyway, it's all about the feel. That song just sets a great emotion, I think, too.
Any stories about like some unconventional recording method? I mean, as we're speaking, we just learned that the passing of Eddie Van Halen last night. He was known for just destroying guitars and putting them back together, and doing a lot of kind of weird stuff. He used a drill, you know, at the beginning of a song in the 80s. Anything kind of out of the box? Something where you just kind of you basically in the process of recording the album, it was invented for.
Yeah, and it wasn't on. It was on Pisces Iscariot, but it was cut during that session. It was a song called Pissant.
Okay.
And the drum sound on that is our drums through a microphonic pickup and a guitar. You can listen to them, and they just kind of have you check the song out when you have time.
Yeah.
I used a guitar as a microphone. Wow. It's that same guitar. It's that Kimberly that Billy played on Mayonnaise. It was just so microphonic. So we set it up in the room like a room mic for the drums.
That's amazing.
And it just sounded so nasty and just was so awesome. so lo-fi. So, there's the sitar. Sitar was a choral sitar, which is the electric version of one. But Billy had a real one. He bought it in. But we never even took it out of the case. We looked at it. Oh, that's interesting. Boy, it's big. Do you know how to play it? No. Okay. So it was there for vibe, I guess.
So during the recording process, is there any type of this? This album in particular sticks out to me because it seems so involved. Although the last record I talked to you on took forever to record too. But is there any downtime for you just being as the engineer? Do you get kind of a little bit of a break while they're muddling through something? Or
no, there wasn't any work these things up. They did know their arrangements enough.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. But there was never there wasn't that. I take that back. The only downtime we had was they came in to do some sort of interview. MTV was going to interview them. And I don't know if I'd shared this story before, but when we were talking prior. But anyway, they were going to dress up in these costumes. The band was that looked like the Three Little Pigs had these big kind of paper mache heads, giant heads. Well, if you there's a DVD out called Vuforia.
Yeah.
That's on that. That's me and Butch wearing the pig heads and sitting by the console because the band refused to wear them the day it happened because they'd gotten in an argument the night before.
Jesus.
So Butch just hands me one here. So they're playing. We're playing back the song today and dancing around in the control room with pig heads on. But then they had some guy do this kind of tongue-in-cheek interview with them. And so we come out there in that video with the pig heads on, bringing them water, that kind of just cheesy stuff. But that's the closest thing to a break that we would get.
Okay. That's awesome. So I guess I got to check. See, that came up during the album discussion, and I got sent the link to the video for that. So I'll be watching that soon. So, I'll know that. Hey, that's Jeff right there.
Well, the first thing most people ask me is, what is that shirt you're wearing? I said, I don't know. I don't care.
Right on. Well, I'm not looking for a lot of salaciousness, more kind of like in hindsight, it's kind of funny kind of
sure.
stuff. Was there any kind of like, you know, blow up between anybody, the members of the band I'm talking about that, like I said, I'm not really looking for dirt, just more kind of stuff that everybody kind of laugh off after 20 years.
Well, that night, but prior to the pig day, the pig head day, the Three Little Pigs was he and Darcy and just having a row. And that's when we kind of knew that wasn't going to, being in a great mood the next day to
that's
do
when
the
you're like
and
I'm gonna have
stuff.
To wear that fucking pig head aren't I
well I remember Butch and I were in the control room when he and Darcy were having it out outside of it, and Butch says let's go in Mark's office. Mark was one of the owners of the studio, and he said, and Butch called him a Frosty, that was a beer. He said, let's go into Mark's office and grab a Frosty, this is going to be a while. So we sat in there drinking beer and just thinking, all right, well, when this is over, I guess we'll go home or we'll finish what we're doing or whatever.
Oh, man, it's those goddamn Sconnies always wanting their beers. You know, I'm in Minnesota,
frosty.
If you remember. But, yeah, so, yeah, there we have a love-hate relationship. But, no, that's I got caught up on my fucking stupid Sconny joke there. So this is Billy and Darcy you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yep. I'm trying to put myself in the position of Darcy. Did she ever think of quitting? That ever come up?
You know, I wouldn't have been surprised, but and I don't know. I don't know. A lot of people would not have been involved in or that uninvolved and stayed.
That's what I'm getting
at. But the same thing with James, because as soon as the record was done, they were out on the road and they were killing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, date wise and stuff, and then the record just started blowing up. So at that point, I can see, oh, I think I'll hang in. But prior to that, yeah, it does make you wonder what her headspace would have been, and James too. And James is a sweetheart of a guy. He was such a nice guy, really cool. He actually bought the Mellotron that the studio owned because he liked it so much. I don't know if he still has it, but anyway, he was just a super super nice guy, and Darcy was too. You know, but. Again, they had their issues they were having to struggle with. So.
Yeah, no, and look, people are human, you know, and I'm not trying. That's why I don't want to. To me, I've done a lot of jackass stuff that if people brought up, I'd be more than happy to laugh at. But so that's
kind of
the way I'm looking at it, you know.
And I'd said just because of his preparedness and him knowing exactly how he wanted the record to be, if Billy could have played drums like Jimmy, he would have played drums on the record too. But he couldn't because Jimmy's an amazing drummer.
He's that close to being Prince. I just need to be able to play drums. You know what? I actually wanted to mention that. I think Billy seems to be someone who really understands music, if that makes sense. Like, he gets, like, the guitar for him is almost like, this is a tool I need to use. But he's actually, he's a phenomenal guitar player, don't you think?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of that lead break stuff, some of that solo in Cherub Rock, it's smoking good. And most of that stuff we may have comped some, but for the most part he's just a solid player. Period. His bass playing, I mean, that's him all over the record. His bass playing solid. He's a super talented guy. The Mellotron stuff he played on some stuff on anything that has Mellotron.
Yeah,
we had on the song, I guess it's Luna. Yeah, that Mike Mills, the bass player from REM. I don't know how they knew each other. He came in and played on that, so that was nice. He was a super good guy to hang out with. I liked him. He walked in with a six pack, well, a five pack, because he'd already downed one.
Yeah.
Asking if I wanted a beer. That's how he showed up at the session.
Hmm. My kind of guy. Apparently, Sconnies aren't the only ones who like beer. again, my dumb beer joke. But the first time I saw the Pumpkins live was performing Cherub Rock on Saturday Night Live. And it was Billy's guitar playing that stuck out. And I'd already heard, I was already a fan of Gish. And I'm not sure if I had Siamese Dream yet or not, or if it was even out. But I was like, holy fuck. Because, you know, there's this kind of like shift with the grunge stuff away from kind of that guitar hero stuff. But Billy had a way of pulling it off that with also fitting it in that niche.
Well, yeah, I remember him commenting on that what you just said about it kind of not being in vogue, but he didn't care. He knew what he needed to do, and he knew what made rounded the songs out. And it's like, you know, again, that part of that song is about, you know, not following and or people that do and you know, the whole shoegazer crowd and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So, again, just he's just a super talented guitar player, and had, you know, we really worked hard on getting guitars really fat and big like that. And I remember him telling me at one point that when they were mixing it, they went in the first day after Alan Moulder had spent most of the day working on it. And Billy says, "What'd you do to the guitars? Take all that EQ off. I like the way they sounded when we cut them."
Oh.
So anyway, but with tape, I mean, here's the thing about it. Tape loses the high end, like the first time you run a pass past it, over the head. So we used to compensate. So the more it sits, the more it's going to start degrading. It just does. That's the nature of the beast. So after 4 months or 5 months, however long to make that record, that, you know, some of that stuff sat on tape for a while. So I can imagine Alan Moulder saying, "I got to brighten these up a little bit."
Is there any chance that maybe Billy has some low end deficiency in his hearing?
Yeah, I know, because for him to he did bass pretty much sitting on some cabinet in the control room.
Wow.
and would just sit kind of, you know, cross legged
right up his ass, and it's just like
more. Well, no, it wasn't on. It was mic'd outside.
Oh, okay.
But that was just what he used as a chair. And I remember him sitting kind of cross legged, and then he just kept saying, "More weight. I want more weight."
Okay. Well, yeah, he's probably just knew what he wanted. I'm making a dumb joke, but well, what about you? Look, when was the last time you listened to the record?
Oh, it's probably been a couple years ago. Unless somebody brings it up, and I mean, it's not something I just think about and grab. But whenever I listen to it, I wind up listening to most of the record, even if I scroll through stuff, because it's you know, it's a pretty amazing record. I'm very proud of it.
You know, music has that way of kind of like when you hear it, it takes you back to certain moments and memories of when you connected with it. Does this actually, I mean, you were fortunate enough to work on it, you know, while it was being made. Does it take you back to that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It takes you back to even certain days doing whatever song,
yeah,
you know, some of the notable songs you're thinking about. The last night when we had finished, we had kind of had a playback party for some people, friends that they had made there, and then we were going to have a party, and it would last the whole night. At one point, Butch is playing drums, and a friend of mine's playing guitar, and I think Billy's playing bass, and they're just jamming in a little jam room. And so, yeah, I remember that party well, because the next day, Butch says, "I got to fly home." He's so hungover.
Yeah. Oh, man. Jeff, this is, you know, again, so happy to have you back on. Great stories. Did we skip over anything? Is there any song tracks you want to get into, or anything in particular that you'd like to kind of highlight?
Well, no, I mean, I think that, like I said, Rocket's my favorite.
And, yeah.
And that we had a bunch of interesting pedals, and there's this kind of vibrato thing on there, and it was called the Vox Repeater.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I'd never heard that before, and it was kind of a one of a kind. Billy probably bought 100 pedals in during that. I don't know, we used even half of them, but they were all out in the room. There were a ton of them, mostly the Big Muff and some different kind of phasers. The Micro Synth was a big pedal that was used a lot on that record to make them. That's why some of those guitars sound like keyboards.
Wow. I love that outro. I shall be afraid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just, yeah, it's a good, it's such a great dynamic record. It really does take you on a journey, I think. just yeah, the energy when it blasts in.
It's an album from it's sequenced beautifully too. Was that Butch or Billy?
That I don't know. I would tend to say it was a combination of both of them. But probably pretty. I'm sure Billy had a pretty good idea how he wanted things to lay out. I've never been good at sequencing records. I just put the good stuff up front. But
well, you mentioned that song "Sweet Sweet." It's kind of actually a bit of a throwaway tune, but when you listen to it in the process of this album, it's perfect where it is, and it needs to be there.
Yeah, it definitely serves a great purpose. The what's the song that's really long and dynamic? Is it Silver Fuck or
It's Silver Fuck.
USA,
Silver,
one of
Silver Fuck. Yeah, yep.
And so those are. That's some amazing up and down dynamics that Jimmy's playing in there. That just top notch playing, just top notch.
We probably didn't give enough praise to the playing that of his drums on this record.
And it showcases him, but it never gets in the way. I mean, he has a great instinct.
Yes,
for playing for the song. That's always the challenge, playing for the song, not for the ego.
And did you know that Courtney Love says every song other than Space Boy is about her?
No, but I knew they had a relationship prior. So. Well, I all I can say is Space Boy was written about Billy's, is it his brother?
It's his brother,
Yeah, but yeah, everything's written about, right, okay.
Yeah. Did you ever meet her?
You keep thinking that, pat her on the head, you keep thinking that.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Courtney?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, because they did the... they did the whole record live through this at that same studio. I didn't do it, but I was around a little bit during that and got to meet Kurt, which was kind of cool. But that was another movie for those poor guys that did that record. It was a duo that did it. And I remember she said one day, she said, I just want you guys to know you weren't my first choice for producers. And as a matter of fact, you weren't even my second choice.
Dear Lord.
Yeah.
She's a lovely lady. Jeff, honestly, I really enjoy our conversations. At some point, maybe we'll talk Corrosion of Conformity because those two records are freaking staples on this show. I don't know.
Good. Yeah, that was a fun. That's got some fun story. So
yeah, Pepper Keenan is kind of a hero for both of us.
Oh, yeah, I love Pepper. And, you know, and again, that was my second hardest hitting drummer was Reed Mullen.
Man, yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear he passed, a year or so ago, 2 years? Anyway, amazing player.
And you made a great point. It's not just about hitting hard. It's about being able to do it and be right on time, too. So, I don't know, for what it's worth. I mean, for music nerds, I think they're going to get a lot out of what we talked about today.
Oh, good. Good. Glad to help.
All right. Thanks for your time, Jeff. You have a good evening.
All right. You too, Jay. Bye. Bye. Jason.
Hey, what's up, Jeff?
You're always prompt, right on the hour.
Do you need a minute? I can call back.
No. Not at all. How you been?
Not too bad. You?
Been good. Staying busy, trying to.
Well, that's good. The Eddie Van Halen nudes fucking crushing me a little bit.
Yeah, that one hurt.
Yeah.
That's that's a big deal. I, to be honest with you, I didn't know. I figured he was going to go earlier in the year when all it was going on. I kind of told my wife, I said, he'll probably be the first one that goes, but he wasn't. But anyway, just sad.
Yeah. It whatever. Did you ever get a chance to run across his path or work with him or anything like that?
No. My partner in the studio, Jesse Dupree, had been the 5150 and knew those guys from the periphery, but never. I don't think they ever played with him or anything either. So I would have loved to have met him.
Yeah, me too.
What a talent! What a talent!
Yeah. No. Yeah. Well, I mean, he made it clear I was never going to be as good as him pretty early on, but you know, I still found a way to be inspired by his music. So,
and that's enough. That's what so many people have said. So I can't play like him, but I sure was inspired.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.